Hey everyone, Ryan here. Today's podcast was recorded live on June 3rd, 2023 at Phoenix Fan Fusion, and Scott and I were joined by our special guest, writer and editor Mark Wade. And we had a great time chatting with Mark. It was a lot of fun, and just want to let you guys know before we get into that, that you can order Alpha Flight number 1. It's a 5-issue series, comes out in August. Scott's the artist on that, Ed Brisson is the writer. And you can also order Night Terror's Titans, number 1 of 2, that comes out through DC. Scott is drawing that, and I am coloring that. That is also out in August. So you can get your double dose of Scott in August on Alpha Flight and Night Terror's Titans. And yeah, tell your store you want to order those. Thanks for listening, everybody, and I hope you enjoy this panel with Mark Wade, Scott Godlewski, and myself, Ryan Cody. Yeah, this is The Illustrious Gentleman. This is a podcast Scott and I have been doing for a couple of years now. Normally we have a topic. Today we kind of have a loose topic, but it's been a couple of weeks and I still haven't really dialed in what we're supposed to be talking about.
Yeah, let's do it.
That about fit the bill, Scott?
Yeah. Okay.
So I guess the gist of it was, I'll say how I interpreted it.
Sure.
And then you do what you do.
Yeah.
Cool. Is now that comic culture is pop culture and everything is popular, where does that leave comic culture? So growing up, I'm of a certain age where like one day I wore a Jim Lee X-Men t-shirt to like ninth grade and I got ridiculed so bad I never wore that shirt again. Whereas now if I own that shirt...
That's business casual.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be like, yeah, casual Friday. My wife could wear that to her law office. So like where does that leave comics?
Yeah,
like,
comic.
You know, when everybody knows who Tony Stark is,
right?
Yeah.
What's the point? Exactly. What's the role of actual comic books in this world?
Exactly.
Now?
Comic culture, but where are comics in comic culture?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a role for monthly comics. I think there's a role for collected editions, maybe.
Okay.
But you know, the problem we had with comics is you could find them everywhere in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and then we did the stupid thing. Magazines start going up to 15 cents, 20 cents, 25 cents, right? You know, Sports Illustrated's now 50 cents. Comics are still a dime. And instead of going with the other publishing trends as, you know, in the 40s and 50s and 60s and just keeping your big fat, you know, package, big thick comic and just raising the price a little bit here and there and there and there and there, you just, the mandate was to keep it to a dime and just keep shrinking the comics. And so that's why they vanished in the 70s, right? Because there's no news dealer that wants to carry a comic that's going to make him 3 cents when he can put Playboy in that same spot and make a quarter, you know? So, and now we've caught up with our ridiculous prices on monthly comics, but it's too late. So you can only find them in specialty stores.
Right. Yeah. Well, so I don't know. Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, so you don't think there's a role for monthly floppies anymore?
Nope.
But as someone who's been an editor and worked closely with publishers, why are there still monthly floppies? I know why retail stores like monthly floppies, but why?
There's still a feeder system. There's still a feeder system to the trade paperbacks and stuff. And they're also just a way of amortizing costs for a publisher. It's harder for me to pay you for a $25 graphic novel that is not going to be serialized as a periodical first because it's a lot of upfront money. I have to wait until the trade paperback comes out to make any of it back.
Mm-hmm.
And as an artist, if you're an artist, it takes you off the market for 6 months or so. A lot of artists I know I've talked to about doing original graphic novel stuff, you know, 110, 120 pages, big fat package of stuff. But that means they're off the market for like 6-8 months and they worry that people will just forget that they're
right
out there.
Yeah. Especially in the days of like social media, if you're not posting new stuff all the time.
Yep.
It's I can see that too.
Also the precarious chain between comic stores and monthlies, you know, the comic stores as they are right now can't exist without that monthly fix, without those Wednesday warriors who go in every week.
Right.
And the moment you start screwing with that system, I mean, any more than it's already been screwed with in the last 2 years,
right,
then everything just falls apart.
Yeah, I read a tweet by a retailer when people were saying like, oh, well, comics are dying, because a certain part of comics like to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, monthly comics are what pays the bills.
Right.
You know, and like you can survive on monthly comics. You might not thrive on just monthly comics,
right,
but they pay the bills.
But here's the other thing, too. I was going off on a side rant about how I hear a lot of people going, oh, well, comics, you know, comics had four times the circulation 15 years ago, or, you know, in the late 1990s, they sold 200,000 copies an issue. Yeah, but they were like 60 cents. You know, so if you run the math, as I do, knowing costs, knowing editorial costs, knowing printing costs and stuff, comics are as every bit as profitable for publishers as they ever have been. Because what are we charging now? $3.99, $4.99 for a book.
Yeah.
So this myth of, oh, comics are dying because they're only selling half as many as they were 20 years ago. Yeah, but they're three times the cost, you know. So
yeah,
there's that. But beyond that, we also have to remember, you know, if, when people say comics are dying, they're looking at superhero comics, like they're looking through the you know, the tube of a paper towel, right? Meanwhile, Raina Telgemeier just keeps churning out comics.
Right.
You know, the am I blanking on the dog? The
Dog Man.
It's the easiest thing to remember, and I couldn't remember Dog Man, but. You know, those things are selling in the millions.
Right,
right.
So why aren't superhero comics selling in the millions?
I think
if a movie makes $1 billion, why aren't there 100,000 more copies of Guardians of the Galaxy being sold this week than there were 2 weeks ago?
Let me turn it around. You watch Buffy? You ever watch Buffy back in the day?
Yeah.
How many Buffy comics did you buy? Ha. See,
I own all of them.
Okay, but did you? And
I didn't buy them.
And did you read? No,
I didn't read them.
You know, how many Star Trek novels have you read? How many? Right. It's right. There's not that crossover that we expect. So to take it the other way around, if I'm casually interested enough to go see an Avengers movie and it costs $1 billion and I have an amazing time, that's enough for me. You know, not for me personally as a comic book guy, but if I'm not already inculcated into buying monthly comics, that's awesome. I can't wait for the next Avengers movie. That's when I'll get my next hit.
Yeah, so I guess it's like just a different fan base.
Totally.
Like they weren't going to read comics no matter what.
No, they weren't going to read comics.
And you're right, it goes the other way. Like, of all my fandom, I never buy tie. I've never read a Star Wars comic.
Right.
I think I got the one like Stuart drew like when it first came out, but after that, like, I don't read like licensed comics. I just don't do it.
And the other thing people keep saying is, you know, why don't we advertise in movie theaters? Why don't we advertise nationally? Why isn't there like a Got Milk ad for comics? Here's the reason. Because you have to find a comic book store. And there are states in the, you know, like in Mississippi, there's like two comic book stores. There's one state in the Midwest, and I can't remember, and rather in the Northwest, and I can't remember if it's Colorado, Oregon, whatever. It's not Oregon. One of them has like one comic store. For
it might be like a Wyoming or North Dakota or something like that.
So what good does it do me as a publisher or retailer to have my stuff advertised if you can't buy it anywhere?
Yeah, I just was talking to one of the guys from Bad Idea the other night, and he was talking about how comics, especially monthly comics, going back to that, are so reliable that he said there's always been just around 5,000 comic book shops.
Roughly, worldwide.
Or I don't know if it's worldwide or in the States, but he's like, it never dips. Over the last like 30 years, it always stays within like 200 of like 5,000. He's like, because when three close, two open.
Yep.
When four close, five open. And he's like, so that market is always going to be there. It's always going to be reliable.
Yeah.
But I just don't know if it can grow. But part of this conversation, at least for me, is like, I liked being like, even though none of my friends read comics growing up, and it was like, but it was something I had to myself.
Sure.
So like, I could go out and have fun with my friends and go skateboarding, but then I go home and I'm going to read the newest like X-Men or something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's commonplace anymore, because again, superhero comics, they're reading something else. Like my kid, I have three kids who all are adults now.
Mm-hmm.
They all just read manga. They don't read any superhero comics.
Exactly. So comics aren't dying. It's just that superhero comics are not the thing. But again, they weren't from the start. They were superhero comics started the publishing medium.
Sure.
But then in the late 40s, they just kind of died out for a while. And it was all Westerns and romance and that stuff. And the superheroes didn't get really swing back into big until, you know, the early 60s with Marvel. So it's not like they've always been the top dog. It's just up to the last 10 or 15 years, it's always been, well, we can do stuff on the comic book page that would cost $1 million to do in films. Well, now we can do stuff on the comic book page that will cost you virtually nothing to do in films, because you're doing it, you know, you got Weta down in New Zealand doing it for you. And it costs nothing.
This is a topic I want to be more upset about, but everybody is so reasonable in their explanations, and it's frustrating.
Yeah, we were chatting a little bit this morning, and we were like, we're just going to sound like those old men who were just like, we're upset because it wasn't like it used to be.
Yeah.
No,
but it's better for everyone.
But it never was.
Right, it never was. Right. Yeah.
I'm glorifying something that was never really.
I don't know. It's maddening.
If you think comics were hard to find, now in the comic book era, imagine me trying to find comics in my 7-Elevens in like 1982. They just don't carry that stuff anymore. When I was a kid, and I can count it. Sometimes I do this to go to sleep, like counting sheep. There were 23 comic outlets, grocery stores, mom and pop stuff, mm-hmm. in Tupelo, Mississippi, where I grew up. So 23. Even 15 years ago, when I went back to Tupelo, one. Nobody else was carrying comics.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough as well that my dad was in the military, so like the PX always had floppies, mm-hmm. But yeah, also every 7-Eleven, every Circle K in California, like everything had, you never missed an issue, mm-hmm. because it was just always in your face. Like, yep. You would just see it and they would stay on the shelves and until the next issue came.
And it's an impulse buy for parents.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was sold right next to at the checkout. It was sold at the checkout. And once, I think that shelf space just became, they wanted more profit out of it than whatever they would get out of a floppy comic.
That's exactly it.
That's why it's not there anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole science of supermarket placement,
right.
and shelf placement and, return on investment for putting your Fritos there as opposed to here has become a thing in the last, in the 90s.
Yeah.
So it changed the way all retail stores work.
Yeah, like the direct market, I think, has both been good and maybe not good for the industry.
Right. I don't think
that's the kind of quality talk you're going to get here.
I don't think
good and bad.
I don't think there'd be an industry if there weren't direct stores. I think that we reached that point where we were so forgotten on the newsstands that if the direct market hadn't kicked up in, 82, 83, 84, I don't think that, I don't think there's a world in which there's still superhero comics.
Scott, did you ever... Because you're younger than me. Did you ever buy comics not in a comic shop?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I used to buy them at the grocery store.
Yeah.
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 Going back to when they jumped up in price, I remember the first comic. I just got it signed yesterday by Alan Davis. But the first comic that made me like a lifelong comic fan, because I had just been browsing, picking up random issues of Iron Man and Spider-Man. But the cover to Excalibur #1 just stuck out of my brain. And I went to buy it. And it was like $1.50.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, that was kind of a lot. But then I looked at other comics and I was like, well, this one's only 75 cents. So maybe I thought, part of me was like, it's got to be better than this because it's twice as much money.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it's like if a comic's still $3.99, I'm like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. The end.
Are you getting questions or no?
Why not?
Sure.
I mean, I shouldn't say that. I'm not in charge here. Please.
Yeah. You can run it.
So do you think that the market impact from the 90s run up and the, does that still have a lingering effect 30 years, almost 30 years later?
I don't think so. It did for a while. We're talking about the death of Superman in 1992, which is when everything peaked.
Yeah.
When everybody was selling
millions
of X-Men,
copies of Spider-Man.
Yeah. X-Men #1, not the best-selling comic of all time. Again, best-selling superhero comic of all time.
Right.
But those Dennis the Menace specials, did you ever read these when you were a kid? Dennis the Menace goes to Hollywood, Dennis the Menace goes to Hawaii and stuff. You ever read these?
I might have had to have read them, but I wouldn't have wanted to.
And you probably never even seen them?
What's Dennis the Menace?
See, exactly. Exactly. Just like people, people are going to be saying, who's Wonder Woman in 20 years? But those books sold routinely 7 million, 8 million, 9 million copies at 25 cents a pop, which was a lot of money back then. So it was twice as much as regular comics. So 92, big boom. Then the huge bust when people found out that investing in comics for their future was a terrible idea, like the Dutch tulips. And suddenly we had the Dutch tulip thing go, and it just completely collapsed the market. And stores closed by the fistfuls, but those that have hung on, have hung on. I don't think it did lasting damage look, but I'm looking at that through a 30-year lens.
Yeah, so that's what I was asking. It was like, yeah. 30 years on, I don't think it's still a tail.
Right, no.
Yeah.
Well, I might not know what I'm talking about here, but didn't you at one point own a store or part of a store?
Okay. Yes, I did.
So you have you know the retail side as well as editorial, yeah, as well as writing.
The whole point was I'd done everything else in comics other than put the staples in the things. And so, you know, writer, editor, you know, artist, letter, colorist, publisher, everything. So I wanted to, that's the one frontier I hadn't dabbled with. So that was the motivation to own a store. And then I may as well have just set fire to my money for 3 years.
Yeah. That answers Scott's question. And the answered question was like, do you still own a store?
No. The store, first off, the store owned me. It's just the tricky part, the trickiest part of owning a comic book store. We're all over the map. Is this okay? We're all over the map?
Yeah, sure.
The trickiest part to owning a comic book store is ordering just enough copies of these monthly comics to satisfy your Wednesday people and maybe your weekend people and no more. Because if I buy, you know, like 5 copies of Aquaman for sale, because again, in the way the direct market works, the way comic book stores work is they buy the comics. They're not like, it's not like a bookstore where they just can send unsold copies back. If you're owning a comic book store, you've literally just bought those comics and now you're reselling them to somebody else. You can't send those things back. So if I buy 5 issues of Aquaman next, you know, this month and only 3 sell, then I got 2 issues of Aquaman sitting around and they have the shelf life of a banana because next month the next issue of Aquaman is going to come along. And then 6 months from now, nobody's going to want to come anywhere near an issue of Aquaman number 4 or whatever from 6 months ago.
Right.
So that is the hardest part is trying to nail that sweet spot where you've ordered just enough to satisfy your customer base and a little more for casual, you know, in hopes that somebody will casually pick something up or try something new, but not so much where you're suddenly flooded in X Factor.
Right.
You know.
Well, I think that was part of the problem with the speculation market too was, well, they still have it now. Order 50 copies and you get this rare variant or whatever. And I don't, that's not healthy for anything, I don't think.
No, that is not a sustainable growth pattern.
But there is a new collectible market that has nothing to do with actually reading the comics. People want those.
Yeah.
Like they will buy 50 regular issues so they could sell that one variant or whatever. There's a weird collectible market that I don't get into, that I don't understand. Really.
I sell because DC sends me a bunch of variants and stuff on everything I read. They do. That's the immediate biggest plus between DC and Marvel is that Marvel might send you a couple of copies of something, but DC will send me a box. So
they don't send us a box.
I got
We're not Mark Waid. You got a box.
Yeah. Yes. It springs to mind the Batman versus Robin stuff.
Yeah.
All of the issues had like 8 different covers.
Exactly.
Yeah. So for people who don't know, Scott did a couple fill-in pages, or I don't know if an issue or something.
I was going to thank you afterwards.
I was picking up Mahmood's slack.
I was going to thank you afterwards, but since we're on the subject, thank you. You did a great job.
Oh, I'm glad we got it on record.
Well,
thank you.
It's right here.
Yeah.
So you got, I mean, they sent you, I mean, not a...
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's too much.
Right. So I sell variants at my table. And I would be willing to bet that 30% of the people who buy them, maybe 25%, buy them, get them signed, and never read them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they still think at some point it's going to be, and it might, like...
They get it because they like them. That's a moment for them or whatever. Right. It's like, but they don't necessarily feel like reading the comic. I could be wrong, but that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, like, when you've been in the business for a while or someone, like, you've worked on such big properties, there's got to be people who just want to meet you. So they're just like, I'll buy something to get it signed to meet them. But it might not be a book they're currently reading or something like that.
If you know these people, send them to my table.
I will. Trust me, if anyone came to my table, then I'll send them to your table.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have a question when it comes to markets. So,
and Scott, I didn't mean to monopolize. I'm so sorry.
No, okay. Please. Yeah.
All right, yeah. All right.
This is how the shows go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've been talking about markets, mm-hmm, and such. What I want to ask is, I've been to Brazil and they do sell like trade paperbacks and these newsstands on street corners, like,
yep,
everywhere, and that's really cool.
Yep.
And Japan, they have like a great like comic scene in terms of like being like supportive and such.
Yeah.
So on the comic side, from creators to publishers and such,
mm-hmm,
what would be the best way to create a culture, like create make it so that culture is able to support comics and not like lead to like speculator markets and such.
Yeah, I don't. It's going to take something, because when I travel overseas, especially like to Japan or something like that, like everyone's reading a manga. Yeah. Like whether they're like a 60-year-old businessman or like a 10-year-old kid.
It feels like we should be having that.
Yeah, but it's weird. Like it's weird. Like if I read a graphic novel on the train, that's people are giving me weird looks. Like I'm in high school again.
This is exactly why I have my iPad with me wherever I go.
You could be reading the New Yorker, or you could be reading
you know, a random issue of Superman from 1958. Right. You don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how you get that. If you, you know,
I think that's the media's fault, because all those years they started every comic article with Biff, Pam, Pow using the Batman.
Yeah, they made everything so juvenile, right?
And just kept everything in an idea of comics are for kids. They still haven't quite knocked that statement into oblivion, because look at the Marvel movie. You know, even with DC, you know that. There are still plenty of people, because now it's Scorsese, now it's all these hoity-toity directors who are like, this isn't stuff I want to do, this isn't a movie, this is a spectacle.
Yeah.
You know, it's still a matter of everyone's concept of what a comic is boils down to it's the thing you read as a child, and then you were supposed to let it go.
Yeah.
Even for the people that didn't read it as kids, it's still for kids, which is infuriating.
Elaborate.
None of my friends ever read comics growing up.
Right.
Right. But they would still say comics are for kids.
Yeah.
Because their parents told them.
Right.
Comics are for kids.
Right.
Yeah.
And then,
there's still a lingering stigma.
But to go back to
infuriating.
Yeah. To go to the overarching kind of theme of this is, I could be on the train with 10 people wearing Naruto shirts, like a Naruto headband. Mm-hmm. But if I'm reading Batman, Superman, World's Finest or something like that, I might be the weirdo that gets the look. And maybe it's because I'm like middle-aged, or I don't know what it is, but it's like, why isn't it okay for me?
Yeah, but if you're reading World's Finest, it's worth the sacrifice.
Yeah. Dan Moore is the best current superhero artist.
He's fantastic. He's so fast. I will break your heart if I tell you how fast he is.
I'm convinced he's not a person. But he's like a studio.
I know he's got kids. So they must be inking. I don't know. There was my favorite Dan Moore story is he sends me thumbnails every morning of what he's going to do. And he said at 8:12 he sends me a thumbnail of a page. This is going to break your heart.
Don't.
At 8:20 I send him an email back that says, "Looks great."
Good, because I'm already done.
At 10:16.
Jesus.
Here comes the page, fully inked. Yeah.
Yes. Have you ever met him?
Yeah.
He's a person.
He's a person. He doesn't have nine arms. He's got a wife and two kids and a very big extended family that came with him wherever he goes. So I don't know where he finds the time.
No, him and Jorge Jimenez are just dudes that are gifted with such a grasp of form and getting things right the first time and being able to put what's in their head on paper immediately.
Yeah, they have. So it used to be you'd see over the course of 15 years someone evolve into the artist they are. Like Mignola evolved for a decade before he was Hellboy Mignola. But then, like Dan Mora, I remember like 3 years ago, I was like, oh, this guy's good. And then I'm like, now he's just drawing everything and he's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, or like Jorge. Like they just start, they came into it fully, fully finished. I mean, that could just be, I don't know.
Although, you know, you talk about the form. I mean, I really do think that sending thumbnail breakdowns ahead of time is the way to go, because that's, you know, first of you, as you know, you get to work it out in thumbnails, but more than that, then it keeps you from having stupid notes thrown at you, like, can you make this panel bigger? Mm. So.
Can I ask you a question? Oh, sorry, go ahead, Steve.
We're talking about distribution. Mm. I noticed that I'm still seeing the Archie Digest in, like, every grocery store ever. Is that, I'm assuming that's successful. How come?
Because those are grandfathered in the sense that they worked with people who also own sanitation truck businesses, if you get my drift. They worked with, Tony Soprano had his hand in getting that stuff in grocery stores, and that's exactly why. And that's why you won't see it. You know, Disney tried to crack it with their Disney Digest. It's Disney, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, and they couldn't hack it after a couple of years because it costs so insanely much to get that prime real estate right there by the registers. Archie just has a special, I don't know the details, but they just have a special deal that's kind of cooked in because they've been there for so long. But yeah, it's there. That's not a reasonable outlet, sadly.
To kind of change the subject, not fully, but so going back to like movies, yeah. You know, movies and comics have different readership. I assume you've probably consulted on media projects.
You would be surprised. Not so much.
Oh, okay.
Not so much.
Well, then, just as like a, you know, as maybe the author of something that's being adapted, or someone who's close to something like The Flash or whatever.
Yeah.
Is it frustrating to you when they make changes, or can you accept the fact that like, oh, it's a different medium?
You just have to roll with it. I mean, you can be upset if you want, but what good does it do?
Right.
You know, I mean,
you're not on set with Grant Gustin.
Exactly. But that said, you know, the Flash finale was a couple of weeks ago, and you know, the show has been. Those of you who cannot see me at home, I'm making the wavy hand sign. But you know, I'm still there every week. And the last episode, there was a moment when there's like six characters on screen, and four of them are mine. And that just felt amazing. That just felt amazing. Is there giant money to go with that? No, there is not. You know, but if you accept that, should there be? Yes. Can you win that fight? Only if you're Ed Brubaker. You just kind of roll into it and go, look, that's the cool part, is I was able to make a contribution to pop culture that extends beyond what I wrote. The end.
You got notes over there, Scott. Let's go.
Yeah,
why did you ask me to do this in Batman versus Robin? That's your note.
Yeah. The panel after us is a Wakanda Forever panel. Yeah. So this room is going to be full of people who love that movie.
Yeah.
What percentage of them do you think have ever read a Black Panther comic?
That one in specific, that's a special case.
Or a Marvel comic.
That one's a special case because it wasn't. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Because it wasn't just a movie.
But say it was a Guardians of the Galaxy.
That different. Yeah, different. Then what percentage of them? I mean, 2% maybe?
Yeah.
Wakanda, you know, Wakanda's different because that was a cultural phenomenon.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, I took my fiance to see Black Panther. She has no interest in superhero movies, which is fine, but that one she wanted to see because it was, you know, what it was, a cultural event.
Yeah. Everybody's making good reasons by why things aren't how I want them to be.
Right.
Right.
Well, but I gotta tell you,
Scott, how do you want things to be?
Right. What's your wish list?
I don't. Yeah. I want it to be like the comic market is in Japan or Brazil. Yeah. Or, you know.
But it is. It's just not superhero stuff.
Sure. Right? Yes.
It is.
Yes. So yeah, I'll dial down and say I want the superhero stuff
there
to
go.
Be.
Like right. Fair enough.
I think one of the problems with that is just abundance, and going back to what Mark was saying about, you know, Star Trek novels earlier and Star Wars novels. When I was growing up, I read, you know, I was a big Star Trek fan, I was a big Star Wars fan, I read the novels, I bought the adaptations because there'd be nothing else.
Right.
We didn't have VHS at the time.
Right, so you had no streaming to find, yeah.
Was over, I'm taking any Star Wars
right.
stuff. But now, you know, with streaming and you know, there's a superhero movie coming out every month, mm-hmm.
Sure.
I don't have to wait. So, you know, if I want my fix of Guardians of the Galaxy, I can just go to Disney
yeah.
Plus and rewatch the holiday special. Or
right.
Right, yeah, like my kid today. Who's 20, so he's not like a child who doesn't understand anything. But he is kind of like a child who doesn't understand anything. He said, oh, do you know there's a new Spider-Man movie out? I was like, yeah, Spider-Verse just opened a couple days ago. He's like, yeah, I looked for it on HBO Max. It wasn't there. Or Disney Plus. It wasn't there.
Oh.
And I was like, yeah, it's in theaters. And he's like, so I can't watch it at home? And I'm like, probably in like 3 weeks.
Right,
You know, like in a month, but not right now. And he just did, he's like, it was just so weird because I knew it's out, but I couldn't watch it.
COVID readjusted everyone's expectations. Yeah. All right, so suddenly we are disappointed that it's not out.
Right, immediately.
Immediately.
Yeah.
The same kid when you show him a rotary phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're old is what we're saying.
Well, but remember too, also that, you know, like you said, to the point of oversaturation, like if I have a Comixology digital comic account, right? World's Finest, when it comes out next week, is not just competing with every other comic book that came out that week. We're still competing with every comic book ever published. We're still published with every... my work competes with everything Frank Miller and Alan Moore ever did every week. And so that's just harder to track. So I got nothing for you.
No. It's fine.
No wonder you drink on these things.
I understand. Like, my position is unreasonable by any metric. I get that. But and my wife points out to me that the way I complain about this is the same as me saying, like, I love all the Harry Potter movies, but I'll never read any of the books.
Right.
Because I just don't need them. I got the movies.
Exactly.
And but the person that says that to me about the Marvel movies, I want to argue.
right. Nope. Can't do it.
Yeah. Like, you always say, sorry, one thing. Scott always says to me, he's like, well, we won. Like, the geeks have won, but then now what? Like, was it worth it?
Yeah. In my infantile brain, the idea that Endgame makes $1.5 billion means that everybody should be reading Iron Man comics.
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen. And
right. Yeah. We were joking this morning, like, there's a divergent timeline, like pre-2008 when Iron Man came out and post-2008 when Iron Man came out.
All right, so let's play this game too. So you see Avengers Endgame. Mm-hmm. You really like Iron Man. You want to go to the comic book store and find out some Iron Man comics. Where the hell do you start? Unless you have a brilliant store owner who knows how to exactly sort of gatekeep for you, go and you find 15 different Iron Man titles and 20 different trade paperbacks, and I have no idea. Batman's even worse. I don't know where you would start reading Batman.
Yeah, I've often thought that DC and Marvel would do well to go the Hellboy route and just make self-contained miniseries that maybe hint to a larger story, but for the most part, if you liked Endgame, this is the, we made this graphic novel for you.
Right, but again, how do you sell that? How do you message that?
Right.
That's made for, you know, if you love Endgame, this is the one for you. You're counting on a retail store owner for that.
Yeah, that's true. Although, going back to your ad thing, I think DC did put ads up at the end of something on HBO Max promoting the comics.
Right, they did.
Or they made a commercial or something.
Right, something I saw.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Superman, the Superman Returns had the graphic novel that was associated. If you bought the ticket at the right time, you get a special graphic novel.
Right.
That was digital only.
Right.
So it bypassed the direct market, you know, and made it more direct to consumer.
Right.
But even then, you know, how many people know about it?
Yeah.
So that, how is it referenceable in the movie? How is it referenceable later? You know, and I think that's part of the challenge where, and maybe I'm wrong, Mark, from your perspective, I mean, at the brand level, you know, is the care really about floppies?
No.
Or is the care about the actual medium that makes the most money?
Do you think anyone above Jim Lee at, you know, Warner Brothers gives a flying...
Yeah.
So are we a family pet podcast?
No, go ahead and drop
the
it.
The flying fuck about, about how much Green Lantern is selling next month. They couldn't possibly care less.
Right.
The only thing Marvel has going for it is that the publisher, Dan Buckley, is an enormous fan of Marvel Comics, and Kevin Feige is an enormous fan of Marvel Comics.
Right.
If not for that, and DC didn't have that for a long time. You know, you had people who were clearly either didn't care about the comics, or were clearly anti-comics, or got all the wrong messages out of comics. Jerk. So they didn't have that. And now, luckily, I think with James Gunn, we have that, knock on wood. But ultimately, yes, it's more about selling beach towels. And it, you know what? Again, but that was what it was in the 70s.
Yeah.
That's, DC didn't make its money off comic books. They made their money off of T-shirts.
Exactly,
and, you know, beach balls and whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Well, then let me ask you this.
Yeah.
If superhero comics need to be saved from a slow death, what would be, do you think they do, and what's your, do you have a solution?
If I had a solution, I would be selling 1 million comic books a month.
Right. Do you think it can sustain? Like, do you think in 10 years there'll be, you know, Detective Comics number like 1600, or?
I don't know. I mean, I've been wrong before. I mean,
you're right, like the higher ups, this is a loss leader for Warner Brothers and for Disney.
Yeah.
So how much longer are they going to allow this to continue?
I mean, it's not the monthlies are a loss. The overall publishing strategy is not a loss leader, because overall, it's a profit center for Marvel and DC, especially now for Marvel, now that Ike Perlmutter is gone, who was the owner of Marvel, who kept Marvel from doing anything that made any remote business sense whatsoever. Mostly that he wouldn't let Marvel print extra copies of trade paperbacks to use as backstock. DC's been doing that routinely. All publishers do that, but DC's been doing that, book publishers and comics publishers. DC's been doing that routinely for 25 years. You know, you print a ton of Watchmen trade paperbacks every quarter because you know you're going to sell them. And when they sell it at a store, the store can order them, and they'll be, you know, there in 3 days or a week or whatever. And Marvel, that system did not exist for the last 20 years. If they sold out of an Avengers trade paperback, there's no replenishing that well. But now that Ike is gone, I predict that that will stop being the case.
Yeah, the scarcity model will purposely.
Yeah. Did that kind of answer the question? I don't know.
That's great.
I don't know.
Scott, you got something? You got some more notes?
No. I'm just upset.
Do you want some more black velvet?
Exactly. I was going to say, this is why you drink and these things.
Yeah. Well, so Batman Superman World's Finest is kind of a throwback book, right?
A little bit.
And your run on Daredevil was not a throwback book, but kind of a classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, are you doing that consciously, or is that just what you like to write, or are you trying to take it back to...
No, I'm not trying 80s, to take
like,
not,
pre, no, like pre-event stuff.
I'm not trying to take anything back to the golden era, and it's not a nostalgia
right,
trip.
Whatever,
I mean,
okay.
It absolutely
so for you, it's not nostalgia.
Not, I mean, it kind of is for me personally, but I have no interest in just trying to say, "Hey, let's make comics like they were in 1975." That's just stupid. Like, I still have all those comics. If I need them, so right. Do you.
Yeah,
and. It's just you'll never win. Then you're just being a nostalgia act. And we both know people in comics who are older than me, who that's what they specialize in. And I'm not going to name any names on podcast. And that's what they do, and that's great. That's their lane. Awesome. But it's just who's talking about their books,
right?
You know, it's both. This is what I like to do, and it's all I know how to do because I don't like to tell cynical stories. I don't like to tell dark, ugly, you know, have a drink afterwards stories. I did with Empire. I've done it with other things I've done that are independent comics, but in superhero comics, you're not built for that. They were built for kids in 1938. They were not built to be grim explorations of the human psyche in a way that Breaking Bad is, you know, my opinion. So where I've managed to make it last for 40 years, I just found my lane of, I want to show you the cool stuff, put a modern spin on it to make sure that it doesn't feel like a nostalgia act, but here's why Metamorpho is a cool character. Here's why the Metal Men are a cool character. Here's why the Doom Patrol kick ass.
Right.
And that's what I like doing. That's my joy.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I remember picking up in the first issue of The New World's Finest. I was like, Doom Patrol's in this.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
But it's like, I guess anything can happen. You can do whatever you want.
That's exactly it.
That's what comics are about.
That's what comics are about. Comics are not about rules. They're about flying.
Right.
So.
Nice. I think you might have answered this one. Oh, wait. Go ahead.
While you're speaking about your DC work,
yeah.
A big theme about your work in both our DC and Marvel is about the concept of legacy. You know, Wally West is huge. You wrote like a long early restaurant,
mm-hmm.
And for Marvel, you had things like Daredevil getting a little bit older, like with the Owl's Daughter, and such. So my question is, while you're talking about that and why both characters are cool, what would you say is the difference between? DC style of legacy and Marvel style of legacy.
I think of Marvel as having a legacy style. I don't think that, I mean, yes, every once in a while, Thor will not be, you know, Thor for a little while. It'll be somebody else, but it never lasts. And we know it's not going to last. Somebody else is going to be the Hulk for a couple of years, but it always reverts back as opposed to DC where you've, because Marvel didn't have sidekicks, right? Spider-Man didn't have a sidekick. Iron Man didn't have a sidekick, but Batman did. Flash did in the 60s. They had sidekicks, and so those characters grew up and grew older to the point where Flash, Wally West, Kid Flash, becomes the very first superhero to take on the mentor's role, to be able to stand in those shoes and become the Flash. Nightwing has since become Batman a couple of times. That's built in. At Marvel, I don't think it's built in.
Is there opportunity, I mean, just kind of at the core of this, it sounds like, you know, you've talked about a couple times where new material, mm-hmm. Dog Boy, et cetera,
right.
Hellboy, as kind of a limited run, encapsulated ecosystem. Does DC or Marvel view the opportunity to create whole new cloth? And I think about like the Vertigo line in DC,
right.
With like Game and Sandman and Hellblazer and That Leads to Justice League Dark and so forth.
Right.
Is there still a want on their part to create these whole new cloth areas?
Yeah.
Or are they willing to put the time and dollars and marketing budget
I
want a variant on whole.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if they want to create like new kind of stuff like that. Like, remember they had the Powerline line at Marvel or whatever, right. The St. George and all that. Like, or even like, was that Marvel line? The new, had DP7 and...
Oh, right, the new universe.
New universe. Like, that stuff never really took off. And so they might be gun shy on something like that. But in my opinion, that doesn't prevent publishers from doing like one shots or mini, right. self-contained miniseries, right. with established characters. Like the Elseworlds line or whatever, stuff like that. Like that's why that exists.
Right. But to your point, like Vertigo was an amazing fluke.
Yeah.
That it became its own separate publishing line and was successful for so long. Every people who buy comics on Wednesdays, and I count myself among those people. People who buy comics on Wednesdays are just resistant to change.
Right.
Full stop. Which is why, you know, you can try to have a new Captain America for a while and do your best effort, and then it's always going to be the old Captain America. Everything reverts back. You know, Kamala Khan's dead for 8 seconds. You know.
Spoiler alert.
Please. Nobody knows this. If you've never read a comic book before. And it's the same with lines of stuff. It's the same, you know, whether you create the Impact line at DC Con. That's a case where they put money in. They put marketing money in. They put big money in that thing. And it lasted a year and a half, you know. Meanwhile, because that's all, you know, but then you get the flukes. Like, meanwhile, this is my favorite thing about the Impact line that everybody forgets. The first issues of the Impact books debuted the exact same day as Magnus Robot Fighter and the Valiant universe. And the Valiant stuff went on to make...
Yeah.
So much money and lasts so long and is still sort of limping along. So some of it's fluke, but some of it's also just fans just don't, you know, they like what they like.
Yeah.
Is there a future for digital comics? Will old school fans convert from floppies to online?
I don't think old school fans will. I think new readers will. I'm kind of the wrong guy to ask because I predicted like 10 years ago.
No, I remember I followed them.
Yeah, I predicted 10 years ago we wouldn't be in this place. I predicted 10 years ago that we would not have digital, you know, floppy comics anymore at this point because it's I like calling it a no pants situation. Like I can buy my comics on digital. They're in my living room at 2:00 in the morning. You know, I don't have to go find a comic book store and go. It's a pants free experience buying comics digitally. But old guy, I mean, every person I talk to who is, you know, over the age of 35 is like, I gotta have it in my hands, gotta have a phone, and I get it. But I don't think you're gonna get those people on the digital train. I could be wrong. Any thoughts?
Go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say, one, in regards to that, part of the reason also, besides we like the idea of having to hold our comics, mm-hmm. it's the HBO Max, it's the Max situation. Mm-hmm. They purged all the stuff. Mm-hmm. You can't get it back. I do not trust.
No.
iTunes is the only thing I actually do trust. I don't even know if I should. I do not trust anything is going to ever stay there.
No.
I can't trust that it's not going to vanish. I'll never own it. I have to buy it to physically own it. I'm still buying Blu-ray.
Right.
Because I refuse to go through a situation where you're just going to take it away because you want to.
Yeah, same here. This is it. Yeah. And it's a huge windfall for companies. I mean, Disney just made $1.9 billion by purging their, you know, the Disney Plus channel of a bunch of shows that they don't have to pay royalties on anymore. But you hit upon it. Like the dark ugly part of Comixology and other digital comics places where you go and you spend $2.99 and you get your digital download and stuff. You're not buying the comics. You're renting the comics.
That's always been the problem with digital. I get on the retailer side, they don't want to undercut floppies,
right?
So they're the same price,
right?
But the fact that digital comics aren't just 99 cents drives me absolutely nuts,
right?
Because for the same money, I can have the physical, I can smell the paper, I can have the
comic. You know it's always going to be there.
And it's always going to be there.
With, you know, but you're renting comics. If something happens on the Comixology servers...
It already did.
Right, sure. Oh, yeah, they melted down really bad when Amazon just said, we know what we're doing, and they didn't. There's, one big EMP blast. And your comic book collection is gone forever.
But then going back to your other point about creating new things when you were mentioning Vertigo... Isn't part of that also the fact that nobody wants to do essentially work for hire creating anymore? They want it, if they're going to create, they want it to be creator-owned, or they get that. Nobody wants to create specifically for DC or Marvel or anything where you're giving it to the store, and any money that comes out of it, like you said, you're not going to exactly get a trickle out of it. You're basically deciding what I do for them is never going to really be my best unless... it's something specific I want here, and I'm well aware of what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think there is some negativity or maybe some backlash against, like, people who still do work for hire.
Right.
When you don't have, like, you don't have to do work for hire, but you do work for hire.
I choose to work for hire. Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of creators who are like, I've always thought, like, I'm a big fan of your run on Daredevil with Somni, and I always thought, like Chris could just do his own Kickstarter once a year and just make way more money.
Yeah.
So, but he obviously loves working on certain characters or whatever. And so, I mean, is that just the bottom line for you? Like, you like telling stories with certain characters, and so you can do that at DC or you can do that at Marvel?
I didn't come in to be a writer. I had no ambition of being a writer until I was like 26 years old. I was going to be an editor. That was my goal. I didn't think you could come up with stories every week. That sounds crazy to me that you could do that with any kind of regular basis. So, but then I worked as an editor at DC for a couple of years, and I work with all these writers, and I got these scripts coming across my desk. It's like boot camp. I'm learning more in 2 years than I could have 10 years on my own. So on the other side of that, I'm like, well, I'm not an editor anymore. I still want to be in comics. Luckily, I've made enough friends at DC Comics where they'll throw me a story here, throw me a story there, and it turns out I can do it. But that's because I love those characters, because I loved them when I was a kid. I have done some creator-owned stuff, you know, but it's not where my passion is. And every other comic book creator in the world looks at me like I'm a freak, because that's the exact opposite of the way it is in their worlds. But no, I like these characters.
Yeah,
I like the toy box.
Yeah, like people have asked me, like, you know, like I love doing work for hire, especially at like DC, because it's the best pay rate I could get. So why wouldn't I like to do work for hire there?
Yeah.
But then everyone's like, oh, you should be taking this time to build your own brand. And I'm like, well, building my own brand is going to pay me nothing today.
Exactly.
You know, where if I color these pages, I'm going to get a check in 2 weeks.
Right.
And also building my brand, no one's going to read that, but lots of people are going to read this.
Yeah.
I like that. Real quick, like storytelling wise.
Yeah.
You always work with great artists. Like, I just made a list, but I'm not going to go through my list because that's geeky and dumb. But, like, Somni was listed as a co-writer on your Daredevil run.
Yeah.
Was that something he pushed for, something you pushed for, or just something natural?
Something I push. I always, if I hand you a script, then I feel like writer-artist is the right pit. But if it's a plot, or if you're involved in the storytelling process any more than you would be if you just got a script to work off of, you're a storyteller, and I like that storyteller. Mark Waid and Chris are storytellers.
So on that particular project, you were doing like kind of Marvel-style plots, and then...
Even with that one, actually, Chris took the lead. With that one, Chris just took the reins, and we would talk over plot on the phone, and then I'd get pages in with some margin notes and stuff, and it's like the Stan Lee method, except I didn't take all his money and all the credit. So, yeah.
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 That's amazing.
That's storytelling. I mean, is that a fair way of dividing the credits?
That's my favorite way to do things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've done work like that before, right?
On Copperhead
and stuff. Yeah.
On my creator-owned book, we work Marvel style, and it's the freest working experience.
It's storytelling.
Yeah.
The credit is not a finite resource. Credit is not a goddamn finite resource. There's no reason not to be able to say, you contributed. You know, give everybody their due respect. Right. Doesn't take it away from me. I mean, you don't think I'm less of a writer because Chris Somney took the point on it.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I keep having to tell people, I didn't do that much work on that book, but thank you.
Right.
You know, I don't feel like I've lost anything by giving half the credit away. I mean,
right.
it's what he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Like, credit's free.
Credit is not a finite resource.
Right.
If I get hit by a bus, that's what I want on my tombstone.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody once, because in some books, colorists are now listed as color artists.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that term.
I like it too, yeah.
And, well, I mean, I didn't care about that term until I started coloring, and now I like the term.
Right.
But I was talking to one guy once, he's like, I get it, but like, what's next? Like, letter artist? I'm like, why not? It's just an extra word that gets to get printed. What's the difference?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It makes no difference. It's and
he's worried about pronouns.
And lettering is his own art style. Here you go, we're off on a tangent again, but you know, in old comics, if you wanted emphasis, you put an exclamation point at the end. If you wanted extra emphasis, you put two exclamation points at the end, or three exclamation points at the end, or an exclamation point and a question mark, or whatever. And I hate this. I hate this for modern lettering, because you did that back then because all lettering was standard size. It all had a standard look to it, so there's no other way to communicate emphasis on words. Now, letters are artists in their own right, right?
Yeah.
So if I want you to punch this word, you can just make it bigger, or you can do something stylistic with it or something. You don't have to.
Yeah, you're not stuck to like an old school Ames guide where.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I'm doing the Leroy lettering.
Yeah, endeavor where you have more than one choice.
Yeah.
It's art.
Yes, there you go. Oh, I like that. That's really good.
Wow. You don't speak the whole episode and then you drop like.
Drop that.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
You're out.
Yeah.
Quality over quantity.
All right, we got a couple more minutes. Are there any more questions? They can be really about anything.
Yeah, about anything, really.
I assume they're going to be for Mark, but go ahead.
Would you be willing to tell the story of the smallest comic convention you ever attended?
Yes. Why, yes, I would. So, this is many, many years ago, and it predates cell phones, which is an important part of the story. So I got a call from a radio station in Vermont. Turns out a university radio station, turns out. They want to do an interview, and I'm like, yeah, sure, because, you know, as you can see, anyone can interview me. I will let that happen.
Yeah, it was the easiest get of all time.
Right, yes. Yeah. I really am. But they said at the end of it, they said, listen, we got a store, and we'd like you to do a store signing. We fly you up. I was living in Brooklyn at the time. We fly you up to Vermont, do a store signing, send you home the next day. Oh, okay, great. I've never been to Vermont. Why not? Let's take the shot. So, Saturday, I take like the one puddle jumper flight there is from Brooklyn to Burlington, Vermont, and I go and I show up, and these guys pick me up in like a Volvo, you know, with the hubcaps falling off and stuff. And I mean, I'm not trying to make fun of them for that. I mean, it's just, I'm saying it was not a king's welcome. That's okay. But then we're driving around. They're showing me Burlington. They're showing me, well, here's the fashion district, and over here you've got where the factories are. I said, that's awesome. Where's the store? I said, well, here's the restaurants over here, and this is kind of what we call, this is the high school over here. This is what our point of pride here, and here's the stadium. I said, great, where's the store? There's no store. There is no store. It's just, they just wanted to see me for an afternoon so they could pitch Dr. Midnight stories or whatever. And I'm in the back of their Volvo, you know, and I'm asked often, like, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you cause a ruckus? Well, there are no flights back to Brooklyn at that point from Burlington, Vermont. I'm in it, and I can either be upset about it and try to, you know, garrote the guy from the back seat, or I can just lean into it and go, well, I'll have a story to tell for the rest of my life, which clearly I do.
This is the same story you tell when people ask you to tell your kidnapping story.
That's the same one, exactly. That's exactly the one, because I've seen Misery. I knew, you know, what could be, so I'm playing along.
Why did I have to be so good at writing Flash?
So then I got back to, you know, the Save On Inn or wherever I was put up, you know, and again, before cell phones, I'm just in much cable TV. I'm watching fishing shows. That's all there is. And I'm calling every person I know on the landline going, if you don't hear from me in 24 hours, this is where I am. So we do it. You know, I'm in bed at like 6. I'm just like, oh gosh, it's been a long flight from Brooklyn to Vermont. You know, next morning they take me to the breakfast. Great. Awesome. Just be nice, just play along, and then we go to the airport, and then once I have a foot on the pavement in front of the airport, that's when I can say, this was a very bad idea. This is not something I would recommend you do with anyone else in the world, and no, I don't want to hear your Dr. Midnight story that you really, really want to pitch. So, the end.
Things like continuity, long-form storytelling, characters crossing over from one comic book to another, these are tools that have been in the tool belt of, you know, Marvel and DC for decades.
Yeah.
And we kind of see that now in live action.
I know.
With you know, the film franchises and sub-franchises.
Yeah.
Stuff. Do we feel that this can work? I mean, is this a sustainable thing long-term to take those kind of comic book things?
I think some of them, yeah. Like that one. I mean, again, I think that, you know, that's how you energize the next, you know, few Fast and Furious movies, is you find a Mission Impossible crossover or something, right? And that's new to the audience. They don't know from this stuff. We've been talking. I went to see Everywhere, Everything All at Once, right? Awesome movie. Amazing movie. Knowing that, and Patton Oswalt was in the audience as well. So we caught up afterwards, name dropping Patton Oswalt. And
comic book writer Pat.
And I said, you and I were 30 minutes ahead of everybody in that room for the first 30 minutes, and it felt, because I was worried.
Right.
For 30 minutes, they're talking about alternate universe stuff and multiverse stuff, and I'm sitting there. This is our stock in trade. I cannot imagine the gray-haired woman over there who brought her poodle in with her to see the movie is really going to get it, but they pulled it off. You know, they completely pulled it off. But it's new to that audience. That whole idea of crossing stuff over and everything can be in the same, you know, you can have Mission Impossible cast meet, you know, 21 Jump Street. Terrible example. But
That would actually be a great movie.
That would actually be great.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but that kind of brings us full circle to the thing where, like, everything's possible now and we were just there first.
Yeah. And exactly. Yeah.
But it's like, again, something like Fast and Furious, like, oh, they went to the moon. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But it's like that would be insane when you watch the first one.
Did they really go to the moon in the last minute?
I think in like nine. I didn't watch it, but I heard.
Did they really go to the moon? Do we know?
I've never seen one.
Okay. They keep saying that's where they're going to go.
But yeah, like that kind of thing, like that absurdist thing is something that we knew as children reading comics, that anything was possible.
Yeah.
And now just like my dad is on board now. You know, like if he sees something, he's like, oh, that's not that weird.
Yeah.
I was like, you were the guy who used to tell me I couldn't read my X-Men comics.
And now you're watching.
Jim Lee drew Rogue a certain way, so I can't read those comics.
Yeah.
God bless Jim Lee.
We were remiss if we didn't get any Brian Augustin stories.
He was the best.
He was the best.
The best. Thanks for bringing down the room. But
that would be his response, too.
Yeah, it would. No, I mean, Brian was my best friend. Brian was, you know, we talked all the time. We talked forever. We talked on, you know, we worked together on Flash. He was my first editor at DC. He was, you know, when we were both editors at DC, we were just thick as thieves. And so it was, you know, it was a huge blow to Brian to pass away relatively suddenly. I mean, he'd had lingering health problems, but not to the point where...
Yeah, actually, the last time I saw him was probably a year or so before he passed, and he actually looked better than I had seen him in a while.
He lost weight. He looked good. But, you know, the lesson I took away from this is he called me, like, about 2 hours before he passed away. He passed away. Brian passed away unexpectedly of a stroke in the hospital while they were dealing with another problem. And so he called me, like, 2 hours ahead of time. But I'm driving... I'm like, I don't like talking on the phone while I drive. I'll let it go to voicemail. I'll call him later. And, you know,
way to really bring this.
Right. So take the call. My point being, if that happened, you know, take the call. Pull over the side of the road, take the call.
I was here, so I felt the same way. When the news came out, someone intentioned it to me in passing. I was like, say that again.
Yeah.
And it was, I was just like, oh no. And they're like, wait, you knew him, right? I'm like, I knew him here.
Yeah.
But he knew who I was.
Yeah, he only lived in Arizona for maybe like a decade, but he really ingrained himself in a lot of people here.
So many people have come up to me at the table.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Brian. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, on a happier note, then let's wrap up on. So when he was your editor, you said you went in editing and became a writer.
Yeah.
He always seemed like an editor who wanted to write more than edit.
Yeah.
How close was your relationship, like on The Flash, like, even though he was billed as editor, you were billed as writer, I assume it was pretty close.
It was pretty close. I mean, he was, you know, it really, there was no Flash story ever written by me that didn't have a huge amount of Brian in it. because it would always be the same thing. Every month I'd call him up, talk about Flash, we'd figure out what to do. I got some ideas, he's got some ideas, and we play one-upsmanship on the phone and make each other laugh for hours, because the best ideas start as jokes. This is absolutely true. The best ideas always start as jokes, because jokes surprise you. Right. And that's the best idea should also surprise you. So we would laugh and we would joke and we'd banter back and forth, and then I'd sit down and write a script, and then I kept telling him, come to the island. You know, I love, you know, you love being an editor, but you got young kids now, you want to see them grow up, come to the island. And he finally did, and he came aboard as my Flash co-writer, which he'd basically been informally that for a long time. And it's, you know, I'm so glad to see him do a lot of good, solid writing in the last, you know, 20, 30 years that has hung on. Batman by Gotham by Gaslight, you know, is a perennial. That's an evergreen book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. We love Brian. Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks for
coming. Thanks, Mark, for doing this.
Yeah. Oh, you bet.
We got two clean cups if anyone wants a shot of fine, premium blended Canadian whiskey.